Money Show with Bruce Whitfield, your number one news and talk station.
Good evening. Welcome to the Money Show. The ANC has fired President Jacob Zuma. It's just not told him as to when it expects him to vacate the office. So we'll talk about that in some detail this evening. A great quote from someone on Twitter as to what's been happening in Cape Town, according to Daniel on the SMS line this evening. One ends, R-E-I-G-N, ends, and another rain, R-A-I-N, begins. The heavens in Cape Town symbolically washing away the layer of dirt that has settled on our beautiful country. That is according to Daniel on our SMS line this evening. We are doing lots on the Money Show this evening. Water is a big subject of discussion this evening. The Bottled Water Association joining us at 7:30 to talk about that. Our Africa Business Report, Andy Rice with Heroes and Zeros. And in a moment, Gideon Rahman, who is Chief Foreign Affairs Correspondent and Columnist at the Financial Times, he'll give us his perspective on today's developments with the ANC and President Jacob Zuma. He's written a fabulous column as to why South Africa still holds a perhaps disproportionately large say in the world that we live in. Plus, an economic perspective with the Standard Bank chief economist Gulam Balim and Mweletsi Mbeki, former first brother Mweletsi Mbeki, this evening, his perspective on today's actions here on The Money Show.
The Money Show,
your number one news and talk station.
I've got that question for you this evening on 31702 and 31567. If you think you know the answer to the fast fact, send us an SMS. Who is threatening an advertising ban against Facebook and Google? Who is threatening an advertising ban on Facebook and Google? That's your fast fact question this evening here on The Money Show. Chief Foreign Affairs Commentator with the Financial Times, Gideon Rahman. Gideon, I really enjoyed your column about South Africa and why it still holds so much sway in the world and why the world still cares as to what happens with South Africa, even though, as you put it, where things are relatively humdrum. If it's humdrum, I mean humdrum locally, but if South Africa's gone humdrum after the Mandela miracle, why does the world still care about us?
Well, I think it's partly actually a legacy of the whole Mandela miracle. You've got to realize that people of my age, I'm in my sort of mid-50s now, grew up in a period when South Africa was in the headlines, the world headlines, all the time because of the struggle against apartheid and then the drama of the story of Mandela. So that kind of lodged it in people's minds. And then I think it, post-apartheid South Africa became, perhaps slightly oddly, but an informal spokesman for the whole continent. You know, South Africa's the only African country on the G20. It's the got the highest per capita income of any large African country. It's got a sophisticated economy. It's somewhere that feels like kind of safe Africa to the rest of the world. So when they want to put a World Cup in Africa, they choose South Africa. So it's got a very high profile. And I think people look at the fortunes of South Africa as, you know, in a way, a leading indicator for the whole continent.
I mean, and also the damage that President Jacob Zuma has done to the image of South Africa over a period of time, which has put us as something of a basket case relative to the potential that Mandela represented, he hasn't managed to erode that completely, not just yet anyway.
No, I don't think so. I mean, of course, you know, I was just in South Africa and I was kind of impressed by, obviously, the drama of the situation, but also the fact that something you cannot take for granted in the rest of Africa, you have an incredibly vigorous free press. You know, every second book in the airport is about Zuma and what a disaster he is. You know, it's that is in a way quite encouraging, although obviously the content of what Zuma did has been damaging to South Africa's image in this environment. And things like power cuts, the headlines about Cape Town possibly running out of water, all the kind of stuff about corruption, which plays into unfortunate stereotypes about, you know, what Africa inverted is going to be like. Yeah, it has been damaging to the image of South Africa, no doubt about it.
I mean, lots of people are really frightened of a Mobutu or a Mugabe sort of scenario for South Africa and that vigorous sense of democracy playing itself out over the last 2 years in South Africa. And while Jacob Zuma may be painted universally as a villain, you do point out that he hasn't resorted to the sort of political brutality that others have done.
No, absolutely. I mean, you look at, well, obviously next door, Mugabe, you know, started with mass political violence. It was very early into his period in office. And the kind of decline that you saw in Zimbabwe, both in terms of the brutality visited on the opposition, on the free press, hyperinflation, South Africa's still a very, very long way from that. But I think one of the things that struck me is that, you know, in a few years ago, people who talked about the Zimbabweization of South Africa were generally regarded as, you know, out of touch or so on. And I was struck that, you know, even quite kind of sensible South Africans would begin to sort of in recent years say, well, you know, if things really go bad, that could be the kind of fate that we face. So, you know, on the one hand, South Africa is still a very long way from that. But I think people were alarmed, obviously are alarmed, by the direction that the country was drifting in during the Zuma years.
As somebody whose voice is recognized as a voice of sanity and reason in the world of global business.
That's so kind of you, thank you.
That's what I'm told anyway. That's what people say about you.
Yeah.
A postponement by the ANC, delaying the inevitable, President Jacob Zuma, if he does drag out his sacking, and it's almost been handed to him on a plate as to he can choose the day of his departure, that's the way it stands at the moment. Does it make a difference whether he takes a day or a week in your eyes?
I don't think so. I mean, I think if it turns into a very long, drawn-out political crisis, which then leads to uncertainty and a sense that, well, maybe there won't be a real transition and that the kind of, some of the legacy of the Zuma years will drag on, or indeed there'll be kind of a paralysis at the centre of government, that would be damaging. But a week, a day, even a month, you know, as long as there's a sense that a new broom in the form of Ramaphosa is coming in and that South Africa has a chance for a fresh start, I think people will be happy with that.
Gideon Rachman, thank you. On the line to us from London, the Chief Foreign Affairs Commentator with the Financial Times. Listening to that, Mweletsi Mbeki, businessman, political analyst, former first brother. Mweletsi Mbeki on The Money Show this evening. The Mbeki household, we know the Mbeki Foundation, delighted and encouraging President Jacob Zuma to go to the Speaker of Parliament post-haste and hand in his resignation. But as political analyst, Mweletsi Mbeki, how are you reading the tea leaves on this one?
Well, I watched the press conference with the ANC Secretary General, and I was quite taken aback when he told me that Zuma has done nothing wrong, and so they just want him to make way for their new leader, which is Cyril Ramaphosa. Now, I mean, I thought that was very childish. You can't remove the president of the state of South Africa just because you have a new leader of the ANC. Remember, the president of South Africa is elected by parliament, not elected by the ANC.
That's exactly what happened to your brother, however, there's precedent.
Yeah, well, I can't talk about the past. I'm talking about what the ANC said today. They said that Zuma has done nothing wrong, but they want to remove him because they have a new friend called Cyril Ramaphosa, who they think he should be president of South Africa. That's hardly a good reason to remove a president of a country who has been elected by his country's parliament according to the constitution of his country.
Tell me how this plays out then over the next couple of days, Mweletsi Mbeki.
I have no idea. I mean, he has said that Zuma has told them that he won't resign. He needs 3 to 6 months, so I guess he will repeat that. And then the ANC will presumably go to the EFF and ask to partner with the EFF in a vote of no confidence.
Do you agree with Gideon Rachman that if it takes a day, a week or a month, it doesn't really matter as long as there is a sense of transition?
No. He's wrong. I was in London at the beginning of December talking to investors. I'm looking for money for a steel project. They said they are not investing in South Africa. So a month or two won't change their attitude towards South Africa.
What will?
What will change? A thorough exposition of how the ANC as an institution has been condoning corruption, starting with the abolition, with the dismantling of the Scorpions at Polokwane by the ANC itself. It wasn't Zuma who dismantled the Scorpions. Second, you can go through, there are so many there's a chain which makes sense. Until we realize that this is an institutional and systemic corruption instead of looking for scapegoats, the investors will not believe us because they know it's systemic.
And that is the big risk. Mweletsi Mbeki, thank you, the businessman and political analyst. Before him, Gideon Rahman, the chief foreign affairs commentator with the Financial Times. Gulam Balim is the chief economist at Standard Bank. The currency was eager to break stronger, and as the fact that there was no deadline put on the president's departure, Gulam, we saw the rand retrace a little bit. There is nervousness in markets.
There is a little anxiety to the extent that we've had compelling indications over the last month that political capital is beginning to be garnered by Cyril Ramaphosa. And one of the key data points would be clearly the stepping down of the apex individual with regard to the edifice that has surrounded President Zuma in recent years. But my sense is that I think we've probably been caught too closely in the center of the spider's web. It's just a matter of time, meaningful time, that I think that the president will step down, that the cabinet will be, that Cyril Ramaphosa will launch a more meaningful assault on corruption. And dare I say, finally, although not exhaustively, that we will have the semblance of traction in reframing a comeback. And I think those will be the key data points that continues to keep the mood lift that we've witnessed so far buoyant and cements our belief in the reform process unfolding.
A cabinet meeting tomorrow postponed. State of the Nation last week postponed. Surely we can't postpone the budgets, which is scheduled and written in blood for next Wednesday.
Indeed. So February is only anchored by the certainty of Valentine's Day. Everything else seems to be fluid. And so the SONA is the policy statement upon which the income and balance sheets, income statement and balance sheet of the state is then expressed through the budget statement, which is scheduled to be delivered in a little bit more than a week's time. So, in fact, there remains an element of fluidity. When will the SONA be delivered? Clearly, we've already garnered indications that it will be delivered by Cyril Ramaphosa. And in that respect, I think we can look to his January 13th ANC birthday statement, when we glean quite a substantial insight into the measure of the man. I won't go into it great length for the sake of brevity, but with a very comforting, pragmatic, and certainly reformist agenda that he laid there. So I think SONA will have certainly echoes of that. And then we wait for the budget to be released. But in a sense, we know the budget is going to be a mammoth fiscal hump in terms of the fiscal corrections that need to be injected so as to set the budget again on a path of fiscal consolidation.
Does it matter who presents the budget? I mean, the budget must happen next Wednesday. Do we agree on that?
I think it is important. You know, we are reminded from time to time that the sovereign rating agencies judge a nation on two elements. One is the will to pay your bills, to settle your debts. Other is the ability. Now, if you consider that when Praveen Gordhan, the former finance minister, was removed from office a little less than a year ago, it triggered ratings downgrades. In other words, the signal surrounding the will towards broad fiscal consolidation had been dealt a hammer blow. So I would certainly and very vigorously argue that personality, the leadership does matter in terms of signaling to investors, to rating agents, to society at large, that there won't be a relaxation of the fiscal levers to the point of recklessness. So the personality does matter. And of course, the underlying statement. So, you know, it would be welcome if we had a statement that is going to be material in the fiscal corrections. And, you know, there would be a margin of premium to be had additionally if the individual rendering the budget had the underlying innate confidence of the public, of rating agencies, of investors.
If we still have President Jacob Zuma hanging on to the presidency on Tuesday night, do we postpone the budget on Wednesday?
I think that you probably will have a situation where at some point in time government must continue. To the extent that if it is gleaned that President Jacob Zuma is shedding the last bit of executive authority imbued in his office, perhaps then the budget can go ahead. Of course, it would be elegant if he steps aside. It would be elegant if we had a new cabinet. if the Sona was red with the full political capital surrounding incumbent Deputy President Cyril Ramaphosa. And South Africa had clearer sense that there would not be policy retracement. There would not be Cyril Ramaphosa execution failure, which would always be a peripheral concern while President Jacob Zuma continues to be a halo figure hanging around.
Gulam Belem, Chief Economist at Standard Bank. Before that, you heard the voice of Mweletsi Mbeki and Gideon Rachman at the Financial Times.
The Money Show.
The Markets.
The Money Show brought to you by Old Mutual, a licensed financial services provider. Today's the day. Do great things. Welcome to The Money Show this evening. Wayne McCurry from Ashburton is tonight's market commentator. Market didn't, not, I don't think it hated the fact that there was yet another postponement.
There's
a relief that there is a slow and steady progress.
Look, at the end of the day, the market expected President Zuma to be recalled the day that Cyril won the ANC electoral conference, because it was inevitable. You know, no matter what the spin is and no matter what's in the public forum, no politician makes life easy for their political enemies. Politics is a cutthroat game.
It's
you
brutal.
Destroy your enemies as quickly as possible.
Yeah, most certainly. One of the great embarrassments of the Zuma administration is unemployment going from 20 to 27%. There was a slight improvement in the last quarter of last year, and people were getting very excited about
it.
It's people getting hired to do peace jobs.
And it's also the denominator change because more people just physically gave up looking for work. And so, in other words, no mistaking it's good news, but it's not material. And unfortunately, we've still got a very, very long way to go to sort that out. But any progress down that path is most welcome, and that's what's happening now. Mm. And we will have a better year this year than the last 2 years.
But we're seeing great results coming through. I mean, Adcock Ingram seems to be turning a corner, numbers.
A little bit of a turnaround event, so yeah. But yes, very good numbers. Certainly, companies done well under new stewardship there.
And Comair flying high, forgive me.
Comair doing very well.
They had low oil prices, which is good, but the economy was not strong in 2017, yet they performed well.
Look, they've performed well over a sustained time period, and you will know far better than what I do. Climb on an aeroplane nowadays in South Africa, there is not one spare seat.
No.
There's nothing. So they've cut the flights to fill them up every single time you fly, no matter where you're flying to, no matter at what time. And aircraft industry is pure utilization. If you get a utilization below 80%, you lose money. If you get a utilization above 95%, you print money like it's going out of fashion. It's a pure utilization game.
It costs you money to fly an airplane from A to B.
Yeah, no matter how many people are in it. Yeah.
And if you've got only 80 people on it, if you've got 100 people on it, you make the extra 20 is profit.
Yeah.
80 may be your break even. The
correct,
extra 20 people, that's
And I mean, Comair truly has done well over the years.
Mm, it has. I think
in a tough industry, seriously tough industry.
It's never reported a loss, not a full year loss. It did a half year loss once, but it's never reported a full year loss.
And not many low cost airlines can claim that. And in fact, what's the failure rate? Something like 11 out of 12 have failed in South Africa. It's 8 out of 9 or 11 out of 12 or something like that.
90%.
Yeah.
At least.
Yes.
Kumba Iron Ore.
Yes.
China, brilliant, a brilliant customer, but I think they're getting a little bit too China dependent.
Well, the whole world's China, the whole commodity world's China dependent, so that's not unusual for Kumba to be China dependent. But yes, good set of results, 31 Rand earnings, 31 Rand dividends, massive cash flow, 12 billion Rand positive cash flow. Remember 2 years ago they cut the dividend to nothing.
Yeah.
And they were not on the verge of bankruptcy, but they were in serious trouble.
What could you have bought? You could have bought Kumba.
$25.
You could have bought them at $25 and you would have
peaked at 400. What's it today? 330 odd or 310 or whatever.
If you bought them at 25, you'd be getting a 31 Rand a share.
Yeah, but to get to 25, they fell from 620.
Yeah.
Okay. So, yeah.
True.
So that is just typical of a cyclical commodity company.
It is. But Kumba, and also, I suppose, to the courage of Anglo American to hold on to what may have.
Look, they were keen to sell when they were almost bankrupt. But then,
they were.
But then the moment the commodity cycle turned up, they said, oh, hang on a second. No, maybe we're not going to sell this one.
Yeah. And they were right. Right. They were right not to.
But if the conditions at the end of 2018 had have stayed around for another 6 months, they would have been forced to sell them because their debt was spiraling out of control.
But their debt's back under control, isn't it?
Anglo's
is very much back in the game.
Nothing ever stays the same, but if everything stays the same as it is now by the end of this year, beginning of next year, there will not be a commodity company with debt. They will all have excess cash, the whole lot. And this is after them being virtually destroyed by debt. And once again, it just shows you what a commodity cycle is, with the emphasis on the word cycle.
Most certainly is. We're in the upcycle right now. Let's enjoy it while it lasts. Wayne McCurry from Ashburton Investments, tonight's market commentator. I asked you earlier, who is threatening an advertising ban against Facebook and Google? And a whole bunch of you getting it right. Ron and Derek and Anthony and others. It's Unilever. It's threatened to boycott Facebook and Google if the companies fail to efficiently police extremist and illegal content. Unilever saying the time has come to redefine what is a responsible business in the digital age. They are worried about the creation of a swamp. I like the name of the chief marketing officer. His name is Keith Weed. And Mr. Weed is very judgmental. He says these companies are to blame for creating a swamp in which fake news and criminal content are being circulated. And he's right. And it's good. Maybe the commercial imperative will force Facebook and Google to be a bit more responsible.
The Money Show.
Your number one news and talk station.
The Money Show, brought to you by Old Mutual, a licensed financial services provider. Today's the day. Get great financial advice. Do great things. Well, Passenger Fenta has responded to the call, and so Passenger Fenta will be boarding the Money Show Express as we talk about a record first half for Comair, which is running BA in South Africa, and Kalula.com made 203 million rand in profits, just 2 percentage points more than the previous year. It's mostly about packing as many people as possible onto every flight, but 13% of its business now comes from its non-airline business. It includes some training, meals, and the like. It also runs the slow lounges. Eric Venter, Comair Chief Executive, on the line to us from Johannesburg this evening. You've had a great year, aided by lower oil prices, Eric Venter, but profits hardly grew. What actually did hold you up?
Generally, the biggest constraint has been the economy, and we've actually seen a shrinking in travel in many sectors. So that's been the big barrier. Obviously, you know, as things are progressing at the moment, in the other news today, maybe that's the end of the constraint. But yeah, we have had a very tough economic year, and that's been a bit of a barrier. Our occupancy levels are well below international standards. So we are the industry in South Africa is flying at about 75% occupancy, whereas it's globally the average is around 85%. And then you've got the likes of Ryanair at 96%, but we're not aiming that high yet. But you know, it means we're underutilizing our assets. We're not getting the kind of benefit that we should be getting out of the new aircraft. So we do need that economic growth. It really is critical.
Are you getting substantially better occupancies on Kalula.com than on British Airways?
Actually, very much the same. It's really just a function of pricing. So it's very much a balancing act as to, you know, how far you drop your prices to get your occupancy level to reasonable and reasonable number. But you know, having said that, we're still sitting at you know, slightly higher on Kalula, about 4% higher than on BA, but it's not enough to really say it's a massive differentiator these days.
Have you got too much competition? We see Fly Safair has outlasted many of its previous attempts at coming into competition with you. They are a rigorous competitor. Mango is being very aggressive in its pursuit of you as well.
Yes, well, I wouldn't say there's too much competition for the market. There's just not enough growth to actually fill that additional capacity that's come in through the competition. So I think, you know, again, it's a function of just not having the GDP growth to fill up that expansion in the market and in capacity. But, you know, maybe in the next year or so, that'll actually be corrected. We hope so. We're quite positive regarding the sort of pent-up demand in the market, because we have seen this contraction, of particularly of leisure travel, but also more recently of corporate travel. And we're already getting that sensation that people are just holding back on travel because they then have got the confidence as to how much, you know, how well their business will be doing next year, how much they'll have to spend next year, et cetera. So they're just saving and holding back. So we do think there's quite a lot of pent-up demand, and we just need that sort of positive sentiment to start coming through to get the spend going again.
How much does a water crisis in Cape Town, for example, affect travel to Cape Town? Turning to Uber drivers recently in the Western Cape, suggesting that there was a lot less domestic travel over the Christmas season, for example, to Cape Town than in previous years.
Yeah, we didn't actually see any reduction in travel to Cape Town over Christmas. It was actually the largest volume of passengers we ever carried. So we certainly haven't seen any constraint there. I think we are starting to see a lot more meetings being scheduled for Johannesburg, so we're finding people traveling up to Johannesburg rather than people in Johannesburg traveling down to Cape Town. So we're hoping that, you know, that balance will occur and that we're not going to see a reduction in total travel on the Cape Town route. So far, there's no sign of reduction.
I mean, you've managed to prove Warren Buffett wrong. I know nowadays he's a big investor in Delta and I think in Southwest Airlines in the US. But many years ago, he so famously said that the airline industry was a dead-end industry, that if there'd been a capitalist at Kitty Hawk when the Wright brothers took off, he would have shot down Orville Wright, or was it Wilbur, and he would have saved the world billions of dollars in failed airlines and experiments. But you have consistently defied the airline model. You've once, I think, seen a decline in earnings, and that was at a half-year period. You've never, not once in more than 50 years, seen a decline in full-year profits.
Yeah, and much to our own surprise, in November of last year, we actually ended up fifth on the JSE in terms of returns to shareholders over a five-year period. So, but despite all of that, you know, we're still trading at a PE of 6, which is a bit disturbing if you think of, you know, American carriers and the European low-cost carriers are now trading at PEs of 20. So, unfortunately, the sort of investor view of airlines in South Africa hasn't caught up with the Warren Buffett view. So I think we're a bit of a bargain, but whether that's going to turn around in the future, we'll have to wait and see.
Are you concerned? I mean, everyone wants the industry to be as healthy as it possibly can be, but that you do see a turnaround and restructuring and more of a commercial approach by SAA in this market?
We certainly hope so. You know, we've seen so many of these plans come and go that I must say we haven't got a huge amount of faith in anyone getting it right this time around. I think it's plan number 13 now, as far as I recall. But, yeah, we hold thumbs. I think one of the big changes now, obviously, is that there's a huge amount of pressure to actually operate commercially and not rely on further bailouts, although they probably will occur. So hopefully there's just more pressure than in the past, and hopefully that's what will make the difference. But I think the ability to actually turn that airline around is going to take more than a miracle. So, you know, I wish them the best of luck, but I think it's going to be a very tough job.
I mean, the more successful they are, and if they become more commercially aggressive, it does lead to pricing opportunities in the market, doesn't it?
Yeah, I think SAA alone needs a significant price increase on average fares to get into profitability, which will obviously have a significant spin-off for us as well. But, you know, in the process, they might lose a lot of passengers. So it's going to be tough to see if they can actually pull it off. I think it's a bigger challenge than what most people, including the new CEO, anticipated.
I mean, 45 rand a seat, I think that's the profit price that you told us last time we spoke. For every flight that goes, you make an average of 45 rand, no matter whether it's a flight between Joburg and Durban or Joburg and Cape Town. Are you still in that ballpark of profitability, or has that improved?
Oh, we're doing wonderfully now. We're at 69 rand a seat.
So that's a very dramatic increase in margin, though. How have you done that by managing the number of flights that you're doing, or how are you working that?
It's a huge combination of factors. You know, it obviously the profit number is the function of both of the revenue and the costs. So with the fleet upgrade, we're constantly getting our costs down. So a lot of it is coming through efficiency. Some of it's coming through a slow but sure increase in selling ancillary products, so selling the hotels and the car hire and all the other bits of it along with the seat. And then, of course, as we're growing the other businesses, we've kind of pooled it all into one big pot. So I think if we took the other businesses out, the number would come down a bit. But it's all the one big pot that's contributing. So it's all the other bits and pieces that we're selling in association with the seat and not just the seat on its own.
Eric Venter, Chief Executive of Comair, flying high. Comair with its best half in history, 203 million rand in profits, 2 percentage points more than last year. Everything going in their favor except the economy and the fact that there is a decline in the number of people who are flying. On average, their planes, I'm saying ships, their airships, their planes are 75% full, global average around 85%. And in the low-cost space, you can get as high as 96 if you're a Ryanair. They're nowhere close to that, but it does provide an opportunity for growth. It does provide an opportunity to see that valuation go from 6 times last year's earnings, and that's what they're hoping for, and from a profit of 45 rand a year ago to 69 rand a seat. It's not a huge amount of money by any stretch of the imagination, considering how much can go wrong on any single flight, but it's a huge improvement.
Money Show. Bruce is on Twitter at Bruce Business.
Iron ore is one of our major exports. In fact, it's a huge part of our trade relationship with China. Kumba, big beneficiary of a recovery in iron ore prices and that demand from China. Temba Mkwanazi is the chief executive of Kumba Iron Ore. Your controlling shareholder, Anglo-American, must be very pleased with you right now, Temba.
We believe they are. I mean, given the significant cash flows that we are generating. Yes, Bruce.
You would believe they are. You don't get calls from Mark Kirifani praising you and saying, okay, Temba, this is the way we're going to grow this business further.
Mark is very happy and very appreciative of the turnaround he's seen in our fortune. So, yes, they continue to be very supportive to us.
I mean, it's a full-year dividend of nearly 31 Rand. It's a huge turnaround from the dark days where iron ore prices were falling and demand was coming off a cliff. But the environment has changed quite dramatically for you. Just give me a sense of how that environment has changed in terms of the demand for the iron ore that you produce.
I think we see it as a positive. I mean, we see a change to higher quality iron ores, where the steel mills are pushing for bigger blast furnaces. They are driving productivity over cost. So therefore, the demand for the higher quality iron ores, of which we are a player, given our high quality products. So that bodes well for us. Obviously, this is also driven by some of the measures that have been taken by the Chinese authority around cleaner air and their drive in terms of the pollution drive. What we've also seen as well is that coupled with obviously the rising in demand, which also has got to do with the investment growth, is that the seaborne supply is not strong as it was going back 5 years ago. So obviously that also bodes well for higher prices.
And when it comes to quality versus quantity, I mean, places like Australia, for example, it's almost like it's swept off the desert floor. You've got to make an effort to dig it out, and you've got greater distances to cover to get it to market. You're not necessarily as profitable as some of the Australian mining producers are, but does quality then matter when it comes to fighting the volume game?
It does, because what it does then is that from a margin perspective, when you then build in the premium that you get, so the premium that we get for our iron ore content and the premium that we get for our size fraction, given that our product is two-thirds lump versus a quarter for our peers. That makes a difference. Having said that, though...
Lump? I mean, this is big lumps of iron ore as opposed to more of a fine granular sort of iron ore, and that's preferred, is it?
I wouldn't call it big lumps. I mean, you're probably talking about, you know, a size fraction of about 25 millimeters.
Oh, okay.
In terms of lumps. So, no, it's not big lumps of ore, yes.
Okay, but the point is you've got more of this lumpy iron ore than your rivals do, and that puts you in big demand in China, but you're concerned about your dependency on China. 63% of your sales go to China. You'd like to see that reduced and have a more diversified client base?
No, I wouldn't say we're concerned about our dependency on China. I mean, China will continue for the foreseeable future to be a big part of our sales portfolio. What we are saying, though, is that we are encouraged by the work that we've done in terms of growing our volumes in other geographies. And obviously, some of this, particularly in Europe, came about as a result of the Samanco incident, which took out about 30 million tons of a product, which obviously gave us the opportunity to grow our sales in Europe and also in the Middle East.
What are the opportunities for you to diversify away from iron ore, being iron ore dependent?
We obviously, having talked about our strategy going forward, we are still in the main very much and a pure iron ore play. What we have said, though, is that in addition to improving our margins and improving our life of mine through our projects around the low-grade conversion to high-grade, we would opportunistically look at any opportunities to step up from where we currently are. But this has to make sense. I mean, it's got to be value accretive, and it's got to be in line with our overall strategy.
When you look at the world of iron ore, and you're looking at the steel mills around the world, I mean, South Africa at one time had a booming steel industry, and it all went very, very quiet. I mean, how much are you selling in South Africa of the iron ore that you produce?
We are still selling about probably three million tons of the 45 million tons of products.
So about 8% of your sales then are in South Africa, and is that deal that you had with ArcelorMittal? It was cost plus a cost plus arrangement. Is that still on the cards? Is it still a productive relationship between ArcelorMittal and yourselves?
It is very much a productive relationship. Clearly, they have the opportunity to take more products. They've obviously had challenges in terms of their cost base, but as far as the relationship is concerned, it's a very productive one.
Temba Nkwanazi, the Kumba Iron Ore Chief Executive on The Money Show. The Money Show is brought to you by Old Mutual. It's a licensed financial services provider. Today's the day. Get great financial advice. Do great things. Well, what an interesting day it has been. It's been a fairly unfulfilling and unsatisfying day in many respects, because we do know that the ANC, despite the fact that the president has done nothing wrong, quote unquote, to Ace Magashule, who is the Secretary General of the ANC. But Ace Magashule is right. The president has not been convicted of a crime in a court of law, because he's manipulated the process so successfully for so long that it's been impossible for him to be prosecuted. So let's create the space for him to defend himself. And he's often said he'd love to have his day in court. Let's make sure that he gets his day in court so that we can absolve him of all of the wrongdoing that he is believed to have committed. Let's clear the guy's name. Let's help him out. Let's do the man a favor. But the ANC announcing today that it is recalling the president. And that was interesting. Dodging and ducking and diving and not giving us particular time frame, however, means that breaking up is a very, very hard thing to do, it would seem. Do you remember Seinfeld? Great comedy series. Jerry Seinfeld, what a legend. Do you remember Jerry's friend George, the podgy one with the glasses, George Costanza? Well, there's an episode where George has resolved to break up with his girlfriend, Maura. It's a funny name, but yeah, Maura. Sorry if you call Maura, by the way, but it's a funny name. Daryl Bristow-Bovey tweeted this today to illustrate how difficult a time the ANC is having in its recall of President Jacob Zuma. Listen to George trying to break up with Maura.
Maura, I want you to know I've given this a lot of thought. I'm sorry, but we have to break up.
No.
What's that?
We're not breaking up.
We're not?
No.
All right.
And you can just imagine that. So Ace and Jesse went off to deliver the letter to the president this morning. And Ace and Jesse are George. And President Jacob Zuma is Maura. And he's like, no. I'm not going to do it. What are you going to do about it? It's that kind of standoff that we're seeing in South Africa right now. It is bizarre. The president is expected to make some kind of statement tomorrow. And his statement could be, well, yeah, of course, I'll step down eventually. I mean, I offered Stephen Critters, my colleague on 702, a 100-rand note today, and he was very excited. I said I'd give it to him when I was good and ready. He's not going to get it. And I think that's the same sort of approach. It's an extraordinary state of play in South Africa, right? President Jacob Zuma has spoken about his loyalty to the party. He's spoken about serving at the will of the party. The party no longer wants him to serve. Will he do the honorable thing and step down tomorrow? There are very few people who believe he will. I cannot wait for him to prove the naysayers wrong.
The Money Show.
The Money Show.
With Bruce Whitfield.
Andy Rice, the branding and advertising expert, is on show in studio this evening. Brand Zuma.
Well, before we get on to Brand Zuma, I thought that was an interesting little snippet to play on the eve of St. Valentine's Day, all about breaking up.
It didn't occur to me. Not one moment. Didn't occur to me. There'd be lots of those, I'm sure, when people do, their Valentine's expectations are not met. Because Valentine's, as a brand, has got people where it hurts as a brand, because you've got to perform on Valentine's Day. And if you don't perform, well, there is not enough care, there's not enough love and not enough attention.
I think it's the greetings card industry and the cut flower industry just keeping one more peak in their sales program on the go.
Does anybody buy Valentine's cards anymore? I mean, I'm maybe exposing myself. But does anybody buy Valentine's cards anymore? 31702-31567. I can't tell you when last I went into a card shop.
Well, they're digital now, you see.
Unless you are a particular kind of millennial, you cannot get away with a digital greetings card for Valentine's Day. That's beyond cheap.
That would explain the black eye you're sporting today, would it?
No, it's well, life is peaceful. So, Andy Rice, Brand Zuma, can it recover?
Or does it have any history to recover from, to be honest? No, I don't think it can recover because the momentum is so great already. But is there any need for it to recover? Because post his eventual departure, what role will it play in society and in politics anyway? Very little.
Mm.
So I don't think it's a big issue.
Yeah, and I mean, whether or not 5 years from now, how people feel about President Jacob Zuma and his legacy at the ANC and what he's done to brand ANC, one of the most, I don't know, has anybody done a study?
That's more interesting, what it's done to the environment, the political landscape, as opposed to his own personal brand.
Yeah, and for the new management of the ANC, as to restore that brand in time for local for general elections, which must occur at some point in the next 15 or 16 to 18 months.
I'm sure Cyril is sitting there saying, yeah, thanks, Jacob, thanks.
Well, it's so much easier to take something that's broken than something that's working really well. So I don't know if he's in that much of a bad boat because he doesn't have to do too much to really shine.
Yeah.
Anyway, let's talk about your heroes and zeros.
Okay.
Elon Musk could do a Richard Branson on steroids.
Absolutely. I mean, there is a bit of advertising called Out of Home, which is primarily...
Out of space.
Exactly. Which is primarily billboards and posters and those kind of things that name would suggest to the sharp-witted out there that it's stuff that's out of home. Now, taking your brand into the solar system and sending it around Mars and making it endure for literally billions of years is taking out of home to new heights, metaphorically and literally. And I think that it takes a real stuntman like a Richard Branson, it's a good analogy, to see the opportunity where normally, apparently, when you send these test rockets up on their first or second flights, you put into the cargo bay a whole chunk of scrap metal just to make the weight right.
Is that ballast in a boat?
Yes. And then if it does come plunging out of the skies in a ball of flame, then at least you know that you haven't destroyed anything particularly valuable. But in this case, Elon Musk has put his Tesla Roadster, his personal one, in there with a wonderful dummy pilot, and even a little Hot Wheels model is in there as well, apparently, and a thing called Arch, which is an extraordinary data storage device on which the trilogy of Isaac Asimov novels have been stored. So there's so many different aspects to this, so many points of view of the story. But I worried, actually. I thought about it, and I thought, I wonder if it really is the first time this has happened. I think it's quite suspicious, for instance, that two of America's top car brand names were Mercury and Saturn. And I wonder whether someone had got there first. I mean, what is that famous star in the sky? Beetlejuice.
I think you're reading too much.
Oh, do you think so? I think it's
possible. You're going to a realm far, far away. But here's Elon Musk who's building his brand. And one wonders then, what brand is he building? Because is he the Elon Musk brand? Is he building SpaceX? Is he building Tesla? Is he building all three successfully? Because he's yet to make any decent returns for people who are pouring billions and billions and billions of dollars into his personal playpen.
Well, I think he's trying to distract them from looking at the figures too closely, to be honest. So this is a wonderful story that's wiped all talk about balance sheets and delivery rates and production output off the media headlines. And I think he clearly is a pretty natural publicity seeker. I mean, his thing with the solar battery in Australia was a story well. So he spots an opportunity and he goes for it in spades.
He does. And good for Elon Musk. I mean, he's your hero. And it is the stroke of genius that he's exhibiting in getting, it's not exactly free advertising, but he is marketing himself very effectively through the actions of the companies that he runs.
Absolutely. And it is, in this case, almost free advertising because that rocket was going up anyway and was sure to be paid by someone else. But, you know, just the little touches, the playing of Starman by David Bowie on the on the craft as it goes around Mars is another little touch that was quite unnecessary from a practical point of view, but perfect from a media, what they call earned media. Boy, has he earned the media coverage he's got.
You've got to stand out. And so many people try cheap PR tricks and try cheap stunts, and most of it falls really flat because we're living in a very, very cynical world where we're completely aware of the fact that there are charlatans and people looking for free publicity out to get us on a daily basis. The number of press releases full of junk that arrive in our email boxes on a daily basis are extraordinary. However, when you get it right...
Well, the characteristic that is common to all of the great publicity stunts is creativity. Mm. It's not mundane, it's not dreary and repetitive, it's not been done before. Every one of those great stunts that comes from an Elon Musk or a Richard Branson is characterized by very high levels of creativity, lateral thinking deluxe.
And you wonder how much of it comes from the brain of the entrepreneur themselves, and how pliant they are with some great marketing executives who are going, you know what's going to be a great idea? We're going to attach your Tesla to this rocket, then we're going to blast it into space, and we're going to put the Stig in it, and then we're going to play Starman. And Elon's just going, yeah.
Where do I sign?
Yeah, absolutely. Let's go. Let's do it. Then somebody else also did say Elon Musk probably just committed the world's most perfect murder by putting somebody in the suit.
Jeff Bezos, I heard.
And sent him off it out. Has anybody seen Jeff Bezos? We need to get on to zeros. Unfortunately, there's always a zero.
Yeah, well, talking about creativity, and in this case, the lack thereof, there is a television campaign on at the moment for a brand called Debt Rescue. And this appears to be a kind of short-term cash loan business of some kind. And it depicts a dinner party where Tarbo, the hero, is one of the guests, and a roast chicken is served, and then everyone's fighting over the chicken. It's a quite gross scene follows. And it turns out that this is a tortuous way to get round to the wishbone of the chicken and saying, you cannot wish your debt away, so come to us and we'll sort it out. Now, I know that people are going to get in touch and say, but it works.
Okay, before we hear why people might think it works, should we listen to it?
Oh, we've got the soundtrack. Yes,
we
please.
Do have the soundtrack.
Well done,
let's do the soundtrack. Debt Rescue, pay what you can afford, which is enticing. It's an interesting payoff line. I've seen the visuals of the ad, and it's styled on the same sort of basis of that dreadful Come Dine With Me. And it's designed to be cringy. It's meant to be feel just a little bit uncomfortable. But that's great if you're watching Come Dine With Me and you want to be cringeworthy and want to sort of want to go and scrub yourself with a bottle of Detlin and a wire brush afterwards. But not if you're selling a financial product.
Exactly, for which you want sort of responsibility and institutional longevity and other things, not just a madhouse over a dinner party. I think you could argue, and I thought perhaps that was the way you were going, to say that it stands out because it is cringeworthy. But just think how much better really good ad have been. You pay the same price for running a good ad as you do for running a... So why not run a good ad?
Yeah, well, what makes it a bad ad, though? And that's because there is this fine line between comedy. And when comedy works in advertising, it's really, really good.
Absolutely.
And it becomes memorable. And people then associate a positive feeling that made them laugh, it made them smile, it made them feel good about themselves with the particular brand in question. Debt Rescue, it's very negative. If you are virtually bankrupt and you are trying to resuscitate yourself, should a campaign that makes you feel a little bit better about that process not work?
Well, I just don't think it's got anything going for it in most of the measures that people would use to look at advertising. Is it the kind of ad you'd love to see time and time again?
No.
Are the visuals in the first 20 seconds in any way linked to the statements made in the last 10 seconds? It's just generally, in my opinion, shortcut advertising. And if the agency that made it was asked, is this the best you can do? I feel sure they would say, no, actually, we can and ought to do better. As I say, creativity is what drives effectiveness in advertising. And a lack of creativity is one of the hallmarks, I think, of this campaign.
Can I put my personal hero to the fore? May
Absolutely.
I? May I? The NSRI advert of the young woman in a church in St. James in Cape Town, very close to Cork Bay. She's standing and making a speech at her wedding, and she's missing her dad. And it's set up so there's an MC seat next to her, and there, you fully believe that the father is not present because dad has died. And tragically, in many families, there is a missing parent at the wedding. You haven't seen that one?
No, but I think I can guess where it's going.
And because I told you it was an NSRI ad. And you, up until that point, you don't know it's an NSRI ad. And she's so proud of her dad, and she wishes that she could be more like him. And what a wonderful guy he is. And the ad ends with dad in his wedding suit. And he is the pilot of the boat going through the stormy seas to go to a higher purpose. To my mind, and anybody who dares to disagree, you're welcome to. But to my mind, that's the greatest ad I've seen this year.
Lovely stuff. Emotional, relevant. You want to see it time and time again. I bet there are, although I haven't seen it myself, I bet there are little cameos, little snippets of visual storytelling that you only spot on the third or fourth time
completely
around.
Yeah.
And it's just, it doesn't look like an ad. There's that old line that says, stop interrupting the things I'm interested in and start being what I'm interested in. I stop making ads that look like ads. Make them look like beautiful little cameo movies.
Whoever made the NSRI ad, you're absolute geniuses. It's brilliant.
Good. Send me a copy.
The Money Show.
The Africa Business Report.
The Africa Business Report brought to you by Export Credit Insurance Corporation, your export risk partner. Diana Games is the chief executive of Africa at Work. I mean, one looks at the political machinations in South Africa right now, Diana Games. Is the rest of the continent looking at us as if we're a bit of a kindergarten politically?
Yes, I think they are. You know, I think everybody's like, well, you know, shame, poor South Africa. But actually in the DRC, for example, you have, Kabila's overstayed his welcome since the end of President Kabila, since the end of 2016. And there seems no end in sight to that just yet. So I think we're quite new at this game. But anyway, it's quite hard to divert our attention from that, I know.
Most certainly. But the DRC is trying to push through a new mining code. Mining companies in the DRC are pushing back against it. Has it got sort of a ring of South Africa's mining charter about it or not?
Well, I think it's quite clear about what it wants, and that is a lot more money. I think the problem is not really with the fact, you know, the old code dates back to 2002, so there's no doubt that it needs to be refreshed. But I think the problem really is the environment in which they're trying to pass this. You have this real political uncertainty. You've got a government that's not shown its kind of credentials in terms of good governance and so on. So the risks are high, and one of the things the code does is remove protection for big changes to the tax and to the royalty regime for 10 years. So there's no certainty for these companies in an increasingly uncertain political environment. And also there's always the worry that the money that you do pay doesn't go back to the communities. Where does it go? The processes are opaque. So there's issues like that. I don't think it's just about the money. The mining companies don't want to pay more money. I think it's about the broader environment that they're trying to introduce this code in.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. And the DRC, of course, needs the foreign exchange. And yeah, it's a fraught industry and a fraught environment. It's really interesting to see how Nigeria is going about getting local procurement, growing local industry. They've gone as far as passing an executive order in order to drive this.
It's not clear how come this is an executive order rather than something legislation they're looking at or whatever. But I think it really is. Somebody's obviously been talking here. You've got to do more about these innovation and science and these areas where the world is going, technology. And I think I think it's good. I think it's a warning bell to companies to look at. Other companies are also looking at how they can make companies, in Nigeria, they're going to cut back on permits for people who already have skills in these areas. They're going to get companies will have to have a plan for individuals. Effectively, if they're going to invest in science, technology, etc. So I think it's really, a start to this whole kind of process. They already have strong local content legislation in the oil and gas sector, which is a critical issue in Nigeria. So, and technology is fast rising as a sector. So I think it's good that the government is looking at it. I haven't seen the detail of how it will be applied. And I think that's always the devil in the detail because a lot of these countries have these kind of mechanisms, but they don't apply them very well and they don't get the best possible benefit as a result. So let's see how this goes. But I think it's important to mention it because companies do have to really start thinking about doing a lot more than just trading in these countries.
And then we're very familiar with the fact that VW has been a long-term investor in South Africa, and they're an absolutely pivotal part of the Uitenhage and Port Elizabeth economies. But now it's interesting to see VW looking to build cars in East Africa.
Well, they've already got a plant. It's been going more than a year now in Kenya, building Polos, as I recall. And they've now been a year in the making a deal to build cars in and it seems like a small market. It is quite central, but it's interesting. They really cite good governance.
Oh, Gina Games, unfortunately, a cell phone signal letting us down there. Let's rather than put you through the torture of listening to the cell phone signal, Gina Games telling a great story about as Chief Executive Africa at Work. VW, a $20 million VW factory beginning production in Kigali in the next few months. It's going to produce three models, as far as I understand it. Kenya's been doing the Polo after VW set up manufacturing in 2016. They're going to create 1,000 jobs. It's really nice to see. They're going to do a large SUV, a hatchback Polo, and the Passat sedan. They're going to manufacture those in Kigali. $20 million plant being set up there by Volkswagen, which is good to see. Thank you very much. Diana Games, the Chief Executive of Africa at Work.
The Money Show.
The Science of...
If there is an upside to the drought in the Western Cape, it is the fact that many, many people are now valuing water a lot more than they did even a year ago, 6 months ago. Suddenly the reality has bitten that the water could run out in Cape Town. That reality dawned in January as Capetonians were told that April was going to be day zero. And then farmers further upstream in the Overbergs region released water from their catchment areas into the Cape Town system, and that pushed day zero out to May. And today we see day zero as a result of greater water supplies coming into the Cape Town system from further upstream, plus a massive cut in consumption from over a billion litres a day last year. This time last year, Capetonians are consuming just over 500 million litres of water a day. The day zero bug has bitten, and it's changing people's habits for the good. Fabulous picture. Hugo Fanica, thank you for your fantastic picture on Twitter this evening of you and members of your family catching water in buckets off a roof at your home. I see a beautiful stone church in the background. I can't place it exactly. But you might be in the city centre of Cape Town looking at that picture. Could you be? But yeah, catching water in buckets. And people are truly beginning to value water in a way that's not happened previously. And it's nice to see. It's the science of bottled water this evening. John Weaver is the chairman of the South African National Bottled Water Association. I didn't even know there was an association of bottled water providers. It suggests that you are something of a force of an industry, John Weaver.
Hi, good evening, Bruce. Yeah, we've actually been going for 21 years, and I've been chairman for that whole period.
Were you once a geography teacher at John Ross College in Richards Bay?
No, but okay. My youngest brother was, David Weaver.
Oh, David Weaver. Okay, well, Gary Oberholz, who's my colleague, said, he was taught by Mr. Weaver, who was a geography teacher. And I just thought your interest in water may have made you that guy. You're lucky, because Gary was never a very good student, I'm sure. as an association, you've been around for the last 21 years. The purpose of the association, these things usually emerge from some sort of lobbying activity or some sort of political pressure. What was the genesis of the Bottled Water Association?
Yeah, we started 21 years ago. What happened? I'm a hydrogeologist. I'm not a bottler. What happened then, one of the big bottlers, the guy running it, he saw the need to develop sort of quality standards for South African bottled water. And the other smaller bottlers, they were a little bit suspicious of his motives for starting an association. And so one of the smaller bottlers proposed me as a neutral chairman. I said, yeah, okay, sounds fun. And 21 years later, I'm still chairman.
And as a hydrogeologist, your job is to find water in rock, to determine where water is and perhaps to siphon it out.
Yes, exactly. And the last 2 months has been crazy for me. I'm supposed to be retired, but I've been working literally full time. This week is the first little break that I've had.
Well, I'm delighted that you've had that little break. I mean, we'll get onto bottled water in just a second, but your assessment of the water crisis in Cape Town and the frenzy of activity as people are sinking boreholes wherever there is a chance of an underground water source, and the big projects that the city of Cape Town itself has embarked upon to tap into aquifers.
Yeah, look, yeah, I strongly support the sinking of your own borehole. I had one when I lived in Somerset West. It makes life a lot easier and a lot less expensive, especially as my wife was a landscape gardener at the time. So I support having your private borehole, especially if you're a person who enjoys your garden and loves to sort of spend the weekend in the pleasure of your garden. I've yet to hear of any major impact on the groundwater resources. So,
but what does your experience tell you about the nature of underground water? Because there is a concern that you could lower water tables and you could then impact the last sort of emergency backup of water in the case of disaster persisting.
I'm very what's the word, equable about it. I'm very relaxed about it. Department of Water Affairs is not as relaxed as me. They've just brought in regulations cutting the use of domestic water by 45%. I've yet to understand why they've done that, but you know, those sort of things are ongoing discussions. That in fact is. Possibly impacted the bottled water industry, but we'll get to that maybe a bit later.
Sure. I mean, and then very briefly, I mean, tapping into aquifers and on a large scale, I was chatting to somebody in the Western Cape government the other day who was saying, you know, the days of large-scale dam building are over. The future is about tapping into the aquifers and ensuring that you replenish those aquifers in the wet seasons. This is going to be the future of water for Cape Town for the foreseeable future.
Yeah, I mean, when I was working full time, I was with the CSR in Stellenbosch, and we were very involved. We actually co-managed the Atlantis Aquifer, which is one of the three aquifers, and the whole of Atlantis got water from there. But subsequently, a pipeline was put in, and the well fields fell into disrepair, and now they're being renovated.
Oh, my goodness.
We've known about the Cape Flats Aquifer for 40 years now. We've known how much water is available. And I was on the original team starting on the Table Mountain Group Aquifer. I believe the Table Mountain Group has got a huge amount of water. The big trick will be just to how do we access it? Because, you know, the Table Mountain Group Aquifer, they're up in the mountains. It's very difficult to get drilling rigs in there.
And that's the great difficulty, but those mountains are like sponges. I mean, you just watch them get wet in winter and they start oozing by July. There's water running off the mountains in every conceivable space. And the nice rains that you've had in Cape Town over the last 5 or 6 hours, again, help the people who go with their 5-litre bottles to every trickle of water coming off the mountain to get their top-ups.
Exactly. And the other thing to bear in mind is that the Table Mountain Group Aquifer is about it's 1,000 to 1,400 meters thick. So it's an enormous volume. But the big trick, as I said earlier, is to access it.
How do you access it? Absolutely. I mean, you're the hydrogeologist. Come up with a plan, please, if you would. And we'll ask you at the end of the show how you're going to manage. When it comes to bottled water, I mean, 21 years ago, bottled water wasn't really a thing. And then it became very trendy to have bottled water. And then people kind of started going off bottled water once again. It's sort of been, it's if I can use the term, ebbed and flowed a little.
Yeah. Yeah, there was a huge, in the first 5 or 6 years that I was chairman, the business was growing at 25% per annum, albeit off a low base. Then we went back to normal times around about sort of 4 to 6% per annum. And it's been growing ever since. There's never been a year when sales have dropped. And I just, you know, for the show, I asked Charlotte Metcalf, our technical manager, to get some figures for Cape Town, for instance. And if we look at Cape Town, the fourth quarter of 2016 to the fourth quarter of 2017 grew at 22%, which is double that of the national growth. So the national growth is 10%, that sort of growth in the summer period. So, you know, bottled water is not slowing down.
No, and I would imagine that the first quarter of this year is going to show panic buying in the Western Cape. I mean, just talking to lots of people in that part of the world, one gets the sense that people who can afford it are sort of going to their supermarkets the day the water truck arrives and buying as many pallets as the retailer will allow them to have.
Yeah, the figure for the moment, because we haven't finished the quarter yet is up by 45%.
Sure. I mean, and again, the base has risen quite substantially year on year. So, I mean, you're selling nearly 50% more water just in this first quarter of the year, as people do then stockpile in the event of calamity. What happens if calamity doesn't strike? What are people going to do with all this water? What's the shelf life on a 5-litre bottle? It's about a year or so, I think. But
it's much longer. Okay. We put on best before dates because it's a requirement of packaging. But in the bottle, as long as you store it, say, in a cool place in your garage and put a blanket over it, so out of sunlight and light, it'll last 5 years.
Oh, really? No problem. Okay. I mean, that's a good tip. That's a very good tip from hydrogeologist John Weaver, chairman of the South African National Bottled Water Association. How much water do we bottle in South Africa every year?
It's sitting just over 500 million litres.
So as much as Cape Town consumes in a day is put into bottles in a year in South Africa?
In the total South Africa. Mm. And just, to put it in perspective, because, you know, people bandy about numbers, 500 million litres sounds an enormous amount. To put it in perspective, I've worked it back to farming practices. That's equivalent to the water you need for 1.5 golf courses. Or what you need for 40 hectares of export fruit.
That's not very much water at all, is it? I mean, it's a lot of water, but I mean, you need a huge amount of water in order to achieve an agricultural aim, and that's a nice way of putting it. Now, I need some definitions from you, please.
Bruce, if I can interrupt, just before we go back to that, and the other thing to bear in mind is, you know, if you take a 40-hectare farm, you're probably employing full-time employment about 60 people, 50 people, and in season about 300. The bottled water business, we asked BMI research to get us a number about 4 years ago. It was 1,800 people, so it's a big employment factor.
Yeah, absolutely. The bottled water industry is a big industry in South Africa, a growing industry, and with demand in the Western Cape as strong as it is, it's an industry that has got legs. I want to ask John Weaver in a moment the difference between bottled water, carbonated bottled water, which I think is quite easy, natural mineral water, natural water, prepared water, spring water, distillation, deionization, reverse osmosis. All of these terms refer to stuff that you can get in a bottle that you pay money for, as opposed to opening the tap. And there is a drive for those who can afford it to buy water. We'll talk all about that, Weaver, in a moment.
The Money Show.
The science of...
My guest is John Weaver, chairman of the South African National Bottled Water Association. He is a hydrogeologist. Understandably, John, a couple of people are very grumpy with you for talking about, in such easy terms, fluid terms, if you like, about the amount of underground water and the fact that, you know, pumping underground water onto your garden allows you this wonderful lifestyle. People are very protective of their water in Cape Town, particularly.
Yes, and very much more so in the past 2 years. I can understand it. You know, you've got now some quite fierce water warriors, and there's a lot of misconceptions abounding. I remain fairly relaxed about underground water. I just wish it'd get used more by the Cape Town municipality. There are a lot of towns throughout South Africa that use groundwater as their main source of water, so it's not unusual. It's just that it's a lot more finicky to manage a whole bunch of boreholes than rather just open up a big from a dam. But those days apparently over of the big dams.
Very good. Now, lots more questions for you then on the principle of bottled water. Tilana and others saying, what about the environment? What about plastic bottles? If you're bottling 500 million litres of plastic, of water, most of that is going into plastic, and much of that into small 500 mil and 1 litre containers.
Yeah, what has happened with bottled water is that let's call them the plastic warriors, the anti-plastic warriors. They've targeted bottled water because they say you should get water out of a tap. They've targeted bottled water as the big demon, but it's not. You know, I mean, if we take the beverage market in South Africa, bottled water is only 9%. So the other 91% are done by other things, milk. Sweetened cool drinks.
But I can't get sweetened cool drinks and milk out of a tap. I mean, if we had 9% less plastic, courtesy of people opening a tap, if that tap was available to coming out of it, then there'd be 9% less plastic around. You can see their point.
Yeah, but as a friend of mine says that, he's when he does a lot of field work, he's also a hydrogeologist. When he drives up the highway and he stops for a beverage, he doesn't want to. He wants to get a cold water. He doesn't want a cold cool drink. He doesn't want cold milk. He wants water. He's allowed to. I mean,
It's allowed. It's not illegal yet. What's the difference then between the multitude of different ways of bottling water? Because you refer to bottled water as a single category, but there's so many subcategories. And you've got bottled water and natural mineral water and natural water and prepared water. Well, just give me a sense of broadly what is bottled water. Let's go through it one by one.
Okay, I'll try and break it up for you. It's actually in South African legislation, it's called bottled water. It's called packaged water.
Okay.
And they deliberately changed the term from bottled water. We were very involved in helping a Department of Health. So bottled water is, I'll remain calling it bottled water. Bottled water is a food product. These legislation follow the Codex, International Codex standards. So there are three groups of water. The first one is called natural mineral water. The second one is called water defined by origin. And the third one is packaged water. Now, the difference is that the first one, your natural mineral water, the water must come out either from a spring or a borehole and must be put into the bottle without the bottler contaminating the water. And you're not allowed to do any treatment, any sterilization, anything like that. The second class is called water defined by origin. In that, your spring water can also fall. So if you've got a spring that you can't get microbially low levels of what's happening, you're allowed to treat that water. In other words, filter it and sterilize it. And say someone wants to bottle, let's call it mist water from a Mpumalanga. It's a niche category. You're welcome.
You go. Mist water.
Yeah, you put up big nets and you catch the mist and it drips down into. It's done. It's done.
Why?
On the West Coast, so you can get water.
I mean, it's rain, yes, but I mean.
Yeah, but it doesn't fall on anything. So you're putting up a man-made system to catch that water. But that water has got a very high microbial content, so you've got to, before you can put it in a bottle, you've got to sterilize it. And so that's what your water defined by origin. And the last one, packaged water, that is water that comes from a municipal system. And you must treat that water, you must clean it up, and you must put it into a bottle, and you must state on the bottle your method of sterilization.
I mean, the likes of Nestle, for example, I mean, if they bottle water, it's simply municipal water that may have been dechlorinated and gone through a filter process just to make it taste different to the stuff that comes out of a tap.
Not at all. Not at all. Nestle is a natural mineral water. Prepared water is Bonacqua.
Bonacqua, that's them.
Bonacqua, yeah. That's done by the Coca-Cola company.
Does it make the slightest bit of difference how it's done?
In terms of
the consumer,
water?
In terms of
drinking water? Yeah. Not at all. Not at all. But I like the taste of water coming from the mountains of the Cape. That's my preferred taste. But then when you carbonate it, we'll come back to the Nestle water. Your Nestle water is absolutely delicious. That high level of calcium bicarbonate with the sparkle, it really is a really nice tasting water.
And then the imported waters, I mean, there's a big pushback against a lot of that simply because of the carbon footprint, where you've got San Pellegrino and all of these Italian waters and waters from the Alps and snow waters and all of that sort of stuff that get imported, and they come at a hefty price tag. Should we be dodging those?
Definitely. Definitely. Support South African. You know, it looks pretty cool to have a San Pellegrino on your restaurant table, but it looks even better to have a bottle of South African water there.
Or a jug.
The guys sometimes get quite cross with me because I drink tap water. I've got no problems. I will drink bottled water regularly, but I will not stop drinking tap water either.
I mean, things like deionization and reverse osmosis. I mean, desalination is reverse osmosis. That's one thing we do know. Deionization, is that simply a process of treating borehole water?
No, it's exactly the same as desalination. You put it, there are various methods of taking all the salt out of the, you know, all water's got dissolved salt in it. So there's various methods of taking the salt out. You can either put a very fine membrane or you can evaporate it and condense it or deionize it using, using resin beds. It all comes to the same. You end up with a water which is not the greatest tasting stuff. And so somebody like Bon Aqua, what they do is they've got a tried and tested formula. They add salts back into the water, so it's a good tasting water.
How do they get a price point on locally bottled water? I mean, for stuff that costs a couple of cents a litre, comes out of a tap, versus the $10 you'll pay for a 500 ml at the garage shop. And there seems to be a massive disconnect.
It's one of the things that I don't... I'm a scientist. I'm not a businessman. It's quite difficult. I do know the bottled water industry is all about looking after the scents. But what you've got to remember, a bottled water, the contents cost maybe 5 cents. The rest is all packaging, marketing and distribution and profit.
Yeah, and it costs money to get it out the ground. It costs money to get it purified and put into the bottles and treated and then transported to the market where you buy it. And that's really the cost that comes to the fore.
That's exactly where the cost lies. And the other thing too is with your legislation, just by the way, it sounds a very moot point, but your water out of a tap is defined as drinking water, whereas the water out of a bottle is defined as packaged water. So the one is defined by the Municipal Drinking Water Standards, the other one is defined by the Packaged Water Standard, which is a food standard.
Which is safer?
If I'm in a big city like Joburg or Cape Town, I've got no problem drinking tap water. If I'm in a small town in the Eastern Cape or Natal, people are going to kill me for this. I would rather drink bottled water. When I go travelling, I don't ever drink tap water.
You don't.
I've spent so much money in going travelling, I don't want to end up with runny guts.
No, you don't. John Weaver, thank you. Chairperson at the South African National Bottled Water Association. Fascinating insights. Thank you.